Hello and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets Show. My name's Ian Smith. I'm the company's editor of the IC. This week's big questions: after a calamitous profit warning, is subprime lender Provident Financial dead in the water? 30 years on from the Black Monday stock market crash, what can we learn from the man who predicted the whole thing? And how are the listed builders and property developers responding to Generation Rent? We'll have Simon Thompson on the line discussing a couple of his sector picks. Joining me in the studio today, we have our news editor, Emma Powell. How are you doing, Emma?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
It's been a busy week, just coming to the end of the corporate results season. And we also have our tips editor, Algie Hall. How are you doing, Algie?
Mighty fine, thanks.
Good to hear it. Emma, let's start with Provident Financial, a company that you cover, which had, as I say, a massive profit warning this week. Its shares two-thirds down, a pretty big fall for a FTSE 100 company as a result of that profit warning. Tell us some of the background to what's going on.
Basically, in June, the company first warned and said this kind of transition, this overhaul of their home credit business hadn't been running as smoothly as they thought it had been. The background to that is basically they're just replacing their kind of self-employed agent model with these kind of full-time customer experience managers, they're calling them.
So this is in the traditional doorstep lending business. Made that change, and we had the CEO of Provident Financial in the studio actually not too long ago discussing this change and the execution risk, which has actually proved to be quite profound, to make this business, that part of the business, more efficient.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, that was a decision they took, and they also downsized the business, reduced the number of agents they had. They knew there would be some disruption, of course. They estimated that would be around 15 million in June. Shares fell, obviously.
In terms of the impact on underlying profits for the full year?
Yeah, just from that business, that business's contribution. And the shares fell, I think it was around 17% on the day that was announced. But it was very much kind of stated as, you know, something that was just part of the transition and then would be a one-off, basically.
They'd successfully transferred a lot of the agents across and they thought that would be just a dip. They were very reassuring to investors at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And even they had their interim results not long ago in July, end of July, I think it was. And I spoke to Peter Crook then, and he said very much that they thought the business was going to be getting back, the home credit business was going to be getting back on track in the third quarter and really recovering. And that was, you know, so still sticking to that kind of same line.
And at that point, we did take the stock to a neutral recommendation on the basis that we were a little bit concerned about a turn in the credit cycle, what that would mean for lenders like Provident, but also because of the operational upheaval, although we didn't foresee it being anywhere as bad as it's turned out to have been.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, when we covered the results, my major concerns were, you know, around the general the credit cycle, that kind of thing. I mean, some people have commented on Vanquis Bank kind of slowing its growth and things like that, but I don't think that was too much of an issue. It was more around concerns about the wider credit cycle.
Okay, and then a massive profit warning this week. The CEO, Peter Crook, who you mentioned, has stepped down, and now a big loss for that same division.
Yeah, exactly. So it's pretty disastrous, hence the, I think the shares closed the day about 67% down, which for a FTSE 100 company is massive. And basically, so starting with the home credit business, that's going to be a lot worse than expected. It's not recovering in the third quarter, the business as they expected. And what's been hurt is not just this elevated kind of vacancy rate that they've had with their agents, but actually the software that they're using, which has details like when a customer's going to be in, when's the best time to call, actually was throwing up some incorrect data. So that's meant that their collection rate is running around 57% compared to the 90% at the same time during 2016. So that's really hurt them. So,
and it's impacted on new business one as well.
On new business, exactly. And so they did think that, there would be, it was then got revised up and it was going to be £60 million at the first half results. They thought £60 million will be slashed off the home credit business. That's now going to be between £80 and £120 million loss for that business, which is massive.
And an added problem that now has come to light regards their Vanquis credit card that you previously mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's almost worse, because that's more of the unknown. So basically, that's concerning. These repayment option plans. Some people have referred to it as like PPI. It's not quite like an insurance product, really, having spoken with the company. It's more that you can purchase this product if you've got an account with Provident, and it basically means that you can freeze your repayments and it won't hurt your credit rating with them. So it won't go down on your credit record with them, and then you can restart them again. So that's what it's like. It doesn't so much payout or anything like that. It's more you can freeze them, and obviously you get charged a fee. It's around, I think, £1.29 per £100.
But you mentioned PPI, and the FCA is now investigating the sale of this product, which they had previously stopped actually selling, and people are worried there might be a PPI style repayment of the premiums paid, and that's feeding into a lot of the bearishness around the stock.
Yeah, so they actually entered into voluntary suspension of selling this product in April 2016, and obviously earlier this week Provident's management came out and said that actually the FCA were investigating the sale of this product between the 1st of April 2014 until 2016, when they obviously suspended selling the product. Like you said, I guess you can see why people are drawing or kind of using analogies around PPI, because it's the potential is, and I guess the concern is, and why I imagine the shares fell so much, is that there is that now the potential that they may have to pay back a lot of money.
As well as the money they make from the back book, from the stuff they've
exactly,
already sold.
Which is around £70 million a year.
In terms of
revenue, gross revenue. So it's quite a sizable amount of money.
Okay. And so the shares actually jumped back up 16% today on Thursday, as a lot of people decided to catch this falling knife. A big holder of the stock is the well-known fund manager Neil Woodford, put out a very supportive note saying that he didn't think that the Vanquis repayment option plan is going to be a redress issue, in the sense they'll have to pay back premiums, that Provident Financial has a good relationship with the regulator, and that the home credit business is actually just operationally challenged. There's no problem with the underlying credit. So that's the bull case. How do you think that stands up?
I mean, definitely, this actually, prior to its profit warnings, was really highly rated. The stock was really highly rated. I think if you look at the just analyst coverage, I think practically all had it on a buy. Management, again, was Peter Crook, very highly rated. Obviously, now he's stepped down and been replaced by the former chairwoman, who's now executive chairwoman. Again, obviously, the valuation has come down a lot. I think if you take forecasts that have been reduced for this year, it's on about 12 times. It was trading much, much higher than that before. You know, you can say, well, you've still, obviously, you've got this kind of ROP, these repayment option plan, the issue of that, and that's a big unknown. But actually, Vanquis Bank is still growing. It's on track there. Management have said Satsuma on track.
That's the online lender.
Yeah.
And what's the big sell case? You know, why should you think the shares have still got further to fall?
The big sell case is, I think, predominantly this major unknown now that we now have around this repayment option plan. It's only just come out that it's even under investigation. I mean,
and the lesson of similar products, I suppose, is that you can at the start can underestimate the amount of potential redress or the potential disruption to the core business model from, you know, big regulatory investigation.
It's like kicking a hornet's nest, isn't it? Now, this is come under investigation. OK, a worst case scenario, they have to pay back this money. Yeah, no, they do suffer, obviously, these customer redress charges. What if then the some people have commented, what if they then decide to investigate further back? There's also the issue of them having to raise more capital. That's also been brought up by some people.
And still the home credit business is in flux.
Is in flux. And, you know, when I spoke with the company, they said, you know, this is very much an operational issue. It's not a liquidity issue or anything like that. But if they still haven't, you know, I think the fact that they reassured so much that this is a temporary hiccup and it's still not sorted, that you can see why people are worried, because you can't just rely on that getting back on its feet now before the end of the year.
And we'll have a new CEO coming in, taking their own view of the business at some point, which is as likely to be negative as positive. Okay, thank you very much, Emma. Algy, now let's talk about the cover feature that you've written this week. 30 years on from the Black Monday stock market crash, you're writing about the man who predicted it and the model he used. Tell us a bit about this man.
I'm writing about a model which was developed by Martin Zweig, who he was a regular guest on what was the prime time US investment TV show. It's kind of well before the days of 24-hour financial news. On the Friday, the 16th of October, 1987, he was on the show, and the markets had been very volatile. They'd fallen by over 10% the week before. And he was asked, you know, what should we make of this? And while the other guests said, oh, yeah, it'll be all right, or something along those lines, he said he thought there was going to be a crash. And then famously on the following Monday, the 19th, there was the Black Monday crash, which saw nearly 23% wiped off the Dow.
It's a great clip. You can watch it on YouTube.
Yes, we've got a link. Online, we've got a link to the clip. Very 80s.
Was Mr. Zweig one of these commentators that was always calling a bear market, always calling for a crash, and then was just proved right at one point? Or were there some method?
The famous permaball. No, he wasn't a permabear. He prided himself on moving with the market. And his model was a way of trying to quantify the indicators that he thought were most pertinent.
Give us a couple of those, because obviously you've gone into them at length in the piece, and it's really interesting how you've explained it. But what are the major indicators that would turn the model to a buy or to a sell signal?
The way I've explained it in the piece is that it's basically working off momentum and value. Those are the two inputs. But when it comes to value and looking at an entire market, the actual level of valuation doesn't really tend to be a determinant of when the market falls. So what his model looks at is the thing that essentially all stock valuations are anchored to, which is interest rates, because that's the alternative that you have. And again, he's not so interested in the absolute level of interest rates or the absolute size of movements. He's interested in the trends which are going on in interest rate movements, which he found historically were very predictive of what happens with them stock prices, or had a major influence on it. So his two famous phrases, which he uses in his book Winning on Wall Street, which is where most of this feature is drawn from, and the reconstruction of the model and everything. The trend is your friend, and don't fight the Fed, which most investors have heard of. But he goes into, he's got very precise ways of quantifying these two really important aspects.
Why are we talking about this model now, apart from the fact that it's 30 years on?
There are two reasons. One is that people are nervous, and it's really nice to look at a model which just tries to quantify some key factors in terms of saying whether that nervousness is justified or not. And the other is because 87, I think, was the first time I personally became aware of the stock market. I was 12 at the time, and there were certain boys in my school who obviously their dads were stockbrokers or something. They're visibly shaken by what had happened. And that, you know, there's that.
Amazing.
Having a kind of actual proper feel of a stock market event is quite something.
Yeah.
And quite exciting.
Even though the markets ended the year up, there was still a huge crash.
In 87, the market finished the year up on where it started, but way down on the peak.
Yeah.
Which and also, I mean, that in terms of what's going on with our market now and the market then, because there are a lot of similarities which are, you know, really quite scary in some ways, you could say, ghoulishly scary. Actually, one of the big differences is that the market today hasn't surged in anything like the way it did in 87.
And what's the model telling us now?
It's kind of backed me into a bearish corner whilst writing it, because it moved to a sell. It was when it hits 3 points, it runs from 0 to 10. When it hits 3 points, it goes to a sell. And as I was writing the piece, we've had this these ructions in the market, and the momentum indicator it uses hit a sell, and that took the so-called supermodel, the model as a whole, to a sell. So the model is really quite very bearish, or what, you know, not, it could be more bearish. It's on a 3, which is just a sell, but it's the first time it's been on a sell rating in over 10 years.
And you've got a really interesting graph in there where you look at and analysis around how it's done historically, looking at what it predicted and where you would be in the market. And there's times where it called things correctly, the model, and there's times where it didn't get bullish again quickly enough, so you lost out on some upside. But that's a really interesting part.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the main things are that it got thereabouts on the dot-com boom. It called the top, close to the top round, and it called it in September. And obviously, you know, that was a big rally towards the end, but it was close. And then also it nearly hit a sell in 2007, so at the height of the credit crisis. But also it's given some full steers. And also it seems to go back to a buy, or it has over the time I've tested. It's gone back to a buy far too quickly, which is possibly because the market's less sensitive to interest rates, rate cuts than it used to be, with rates being lower. And also it's actually gone back to buys when it's given these very early buys, when there have also been other negative factors at work, which Zweig highlighted as kind of bear market factors. So possibly those buy signals, those buy calls by the model, should have been overlooked for those reasons. But it's explained in the piece.
Yeah, I recommend anyone read it. There's plenty more detail in there, also about how the model is put together, the different indicators therein, and crucially, an investable angle around, if you believe what the model is telling us right now, what should you do as a private investor as a result? So do pick up the magazine and have a look at that. And actually, we've got a nice accompanying secondary feature this week looking at rising interest rates, US interest rates, and how they might impact on the gold price, because that's one of the assets people will buy if they think that equity valuations are about to collapse.
Classic safe haven. Also, I think it's worth mentioning Chris Dillow's piece on the house builders, because he's gone back and tested a strategy of selling when share prices go below the 200-day moving average. And it's very interesting, the piece itself. And also it's that reminder that you can often profit more by doing nothing. If you try and time the market, it can be quite a dangerous game.
Exactly right. But yeah, plenty of good pieces there about protecting your downside. Thank you very much, Algie.
Thank you.
And now joining us on the line, we have our small cap stock picking guru, Simon Thompson. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing well. Looking forward to the cricket this weekend again, but hopefully it'll last a bit longer than last weekend.
Yeah,
so, we shall see.
What's weather like out there?
It's a bit cloudy, to be honest, but the forecast for tomorrow is great. So a good start to the bank holiday.
Glorious. This week we're going to talk about build to rent and the private rented sector, actually, in general. There's a real trend that a lot of people are focusing on at the moment, and you've picked out a couple of smaller cap companies that operate in this area.
Yeah, I mean, what interests me is the dynamics behind this market. The share of UK households in private rented accommodation has increased from roughly 12% back in 2012 to almost 20% last year.
And it doesn't look like turning around at all as a trend.
Not a chance. I mean, you've got a decade's worth of booming house prices in the southeast of England, tighter mortgage lending criteria after the government introduced some new regulations in 2014. You've got generation rents, millennials basically unable to afford to buy without the help of mum and dad. And this is putting huge pressure on private rented accommodation. I mean, I've spoken to industry experts who see potential for over 1 million more households moving into private rented sector by 2021. And I've looked at research as well from institutions, and Jones Lang LaSalle indicate that almost 80% of institutional investors they surveyed plan to actually increase their investment in alternative assets, with the top pick being private rented sector accommodation.
The UK pension funds that I used to report on in a past life, they have familiarity with student accommodation, and then have a growing kind of relationship and interest in the private rented sector, having largely stuck to commercial property. So there's a big kind of capital supply there into the sector too. And you've picked out one company, Watkin Jones, that started off within student accommodation, used to be its specialism, and it is pushing into the build to rent market.
Oh no, in a big way. It's now got a pipeline of six schemes. It's just announced a 322 unit scheme in Leicester. It's got another in Belfast, roughly over 1,000 units in total in that pipeline. What interests me on this company is that their pipeline of student accommodation for this year and next is completely forward sold to institutions. So the earnings forecasts for analysts are absolutely in the bag. 2019, two-thirds of the pipeline of 3,200 beds that they're actually building is actually in legal hands of solicitors to forward sell those to institutions as well. So we're basically guaranteed from this company £140 million worth of pre-tax profit, 45 pence worth of cumulative earnings per share over the next three financial years, and probably about 22 pence worth of cumulative dividends. Its cash pile, as it actually completes these projects and hands them over to the institutions, is just going to increase and increase and increase. And what it's doing is actually recycling that cash into private rented sector accommodation. And we can actually buy these shares, net of cash in the balance sheet, for roughly 11.5 times earnings forecast for the next financial year, which in my view is pretty cheap. There's a dividend yield of 3.6%. So I put the readers into the stock when it IPO'd last year, roughly April or thereabouts, and they've doubled the money. But I can see another 25% upside to this stock if my figures are right.
Also, I suppose the student sector, we should just say there's a huge amount of demand there for a student accommodation. That's not going away.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And what some people have raised, which is rightly, post-Brexit there are certain conditions which hamper students' ability to actually come to the UK, what they fail to realise is that sterling has absolutely plummeted in the last 2 years. But back in November 2015, you could get €1.44 to your pound. It's now €1.08.5. That's a 25% devaluation. And what that means is that a student paying £9,000 worth of tuition fees was paying €13,000 equivalent 2 years ago, is now paying well less than €10,000. And who knows, it could be €9,000 if we go to parity against the euro. So in effect, the affordability in a post-Brexit environment, the affordability of universities in Britain has actually improved dramatically.
And just touching on the institutionalisation of the residential property market, you've touched on Mountain View Estates, a company that will really benefit from this whole trend towards renting for longer term.
Well, this is an interesting one. I put it into my bargain share portfolio a couple of years ago. It's done well. It pays a decent dividend and quite tightly held shares. What appeals to me here is that it's got a portfolio of 3,800 or so units subject to regulated tenancies, life tenancies, sure tenancies, and ground rents. And basically, when most of these properties become vacant, it tarts them up and sells them. Well, I was looking through the accounts, which have just literally come out. And if you look at note 4 of the 2017 annual report and accounts, it shows that the company actually sold 182 units last financial year, average price £230,000, and that average price reflects the fact that 50% of the portfolio is actually based in London and another 16% in the southeast of England. But anyway, it raised roughly £60 million worth of gross proceeds from these 182 sales. Well, the book cost of those properties was £20 million in the balance sheet. And when those properties were last valued, which was September 2014 by property agents Allsops, they actually valued them just over £40 million. So basically, Mount View has achieved a premium of almost 50% to the last open market valuation on those properties. Now, if you read that across the last valuation of the portfolio, which was £666 million, or more or less double the carrying value in the accounts, then I reckon these shares are trading roughly on a 40 to 45% discount to the underlying net asset value of the company. And it's not even as if it's highly geared. I mean, debt is £31 million. I mean, you know, that's against portfolio probably well in excess of £700 million now. It pays a decent dividend. It doesn't have to sell properties to pay the dividend. It's got an £18 million rental, which easily covers the £800,000 interest cost in its borrowings, covers the £5 million admin costs, and that leaves about £12 million to pay a dividend of £3 a share to give a yield of 2.5%. And I just feel that on a 40 to 45% discount to what I reckon is actually the underlying net asset value of this company, the discount is just too deep.
Yeah, and you mentioned Watkin Jones and Mountain View in a little more length in this week's column, but you've got just one extra company in the similar sector for us that you wanted to mention today, an investment trust.
I highlighted this in a column on the website, Trio of Small Cap Value Plays, and the company's Alpha Real Trust. It's basically an investor in high-yielding property and asset-backed debt and equity investments in Europe. It's done incredibly well. I put the readers in February last year at 80 pence. Stock price now is about £1.30, including dividends. That's returned about 67% in 18 months. I reckon there's far more to come from this company. The reason for that is the discount to net asset value is still only 22%. When I put the readers in, it was roughly 33%. So despite the fact the share price has rocketed, it's mainly as a result of the investment gains this company has actually generated. And so far this year, it's realised £50 million worth of disposals, well-timed, including selling a stake in small listed property company Industrial Multi-Property Trust to 5250 Group Hanstein, which I think we're featuring in the magazine this week.
Yes.
And it basically also sold a stake, a 70% stake in a shopping centre over in Madrid, which has done really well and continues to do well, irrespective of increases in footfall, because sterling keeps on falling. So the sterling value of that asset just keeps on going up and up and up and up. This company's got £113 investment portfolio. So what really interested me is it's got two build-to-rent projects. It's bought the land, one in Leeds, Alpha's Monk Bridge project. It's got planning consent for 300 residential units, some commercial space as well, and outline planning for another 300 residential units. That's a gross development value of £55 million. It's got another scheme in central Birmingham where it owns the Unity and Armouries developments. It's got consent there for 160 residential units or so, gross development value of £33 million. Well, in total, that's almost £90 million worth of development value, which is quite chunky for a company with investment portfolio of £113 million. So it's going to look for potential joint funding partners. I don't think it's going to have any problem getting them. And I can see some decent upside in these developments when they're actually built out, given what the property markets in Leeds and Birmingham are doing at the moment. So that's quite exciting. It's trading on 21% discount to net asset value. The share price in the market today is about £1.30. I've got a target of £1.45, plus there's dividends as well. You get a quarterly dividend from this as well, so it's good for income stocks.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. Fascinating as always, and have a lovely bank holiday weekend.
Absolutely, and same to you.
And elsewhere in this week's issue, we have a sector focus looking at the prospects for big tobacco following the intervention or preceding the intervention of the Food and Drug Administration in the States. We also have a new spotlight on Kosmos Energy, a high-profile oil company that took a secondary listing this week on the London market. As I say, there's an interesting piece on gold and how it react to rising US interest rates and the unwinding of the Fed's balance sheet. All that and more for £4.90 in all good news agents, and we'll see you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.